Bitcoin is over 100,000. We are so back, woo! Baby. David, even ETH is catching a bid.
What? No way.
Yeah.
Right after Ethereum ships its biggest upgrade ever. What's inside of it? Also, what comes next? And also, what was it missing?
We also have Apple's walled garden just opened the door for crypto. It's wide open for us now. Coinbase makes its biggest acquisition of all time. And Washington, D.C. suddenly wants $2 trillion in stablecoins.
We're going to talk about all of that. But first, we got to get to the markets because, Ryan, the markets are looking good. They are feeling good. I don't know what was in the water or air this morning, but I woke up and saw green across the charts. Bitcoin is up 3.8%, broke through $100,000 to where we are right now at the time of recording, $101,000 Bitcoin. It's moved pretty big on the last like 2 weeks, just grinding up slowly until suddenly we're up like $7,000 on the week. Ether price, Ryan, it was up 1% more than Bitcoin last week. I think Bitcoin was up 3% last week. Ether was up 4% last week. Bitcoin is up 4% this week. ETH is up almost 11% this week. So we are for 2 weeks of Ryan Sean Adams returning back to Bankless. And ETH is green. If it continues to be like this, he can never leave again.
Oh, my God.
The ratio is up 7%. We are above a 0.02 number. Still very low.
Okay.
But
so
it is climbing.
We got a double-digit day in the last 24 hours.
Double-digit day, yeah.
ETH is up 14%.
Uh-huh.
It never does that.
Yeah.
It doesn't do that. Like, okay, what's the explanation for this?
I do not. I cannot figure out why. I don't know what the news is.
It's one of those more buyers than sellers kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, traditional equities markets is up pretty big too. Like my Robinhood portfolio, which entirely is consisted of Coinbase stock and Robinhood stock, is also
A nice balanced portfolio across all the stocks that represent America.
Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah.
Okay, well, like, the big question is, are we still in a bear, or did we ever go into a bear market, right? That's what people were saying, I think, when you know, like I was away. It does not feel like a bear market when Bitcoin is over 100K. In fact, this feels very bullish. And we got total crypto market cap. What's the price here? Am I seeing $3.25
trillion? Like, $3.25 trillion. I think it might be even a little bit higher right now. We are threatening to cross $3.3 trillion. As a reminder, the all-time high of the crypto market cap, total crypto market cap, is $3.9 trillion. We are at $3.3. Bitcoin dominance is also higher than it has ever been in a long, long time.
Yeah.
Of course, Bitcoin dominance started at 100%, but it like bottomed down at like 33 or 40% just a number of years ago, like in the 2021 era. It is at like 67%. So Bitcoin dominance continues to make all-time high. Down today, though. Down very bigly today.
Yeah. Do you see Raoul Paul called the top of Bitcoin dominance?
Yeah, I've seen more and more call. People call the top of Bitcoin dominance.
And I'm wondering if you want to make a call, David.
I hate it when you do this.
Okay, so is this the bull market? Is this back? Are you going to say it's back and then curse us and you were going to crash down, you know, another 30% or something?
Man, I don't know. I don't know, man. I don't know how to make these calls. I don't know. Sure, we never left, you know?
We never left. Yeah, we always saw this. You know what? I feel like on the week to week, it's impossible to call markets. Yeah. You're just like in the noise in the weekly when we look at this. But like, yeah, secular bull trend, I guess, resumes. You want to talk about the Fed though? They had their meeting. They have those every once in a while, and everyone was waiting for what would Jerome Powell do. Mm-hmm. So would he raise rates? What did he do, David?
I was hoping you would tell me, actually.
He did absolutely nothing, what he did. He's keeping everything
exact
same. We're
up on no rate changes. That's good. That means that's our win.
Do you want me to give you the summary?
Please
of
do.
Of what Powell said?
Please do.
Wait and see.
Oh.
That's what he said. Yeah.
Okay.
He's keeping the Fed interest rates at the target range, 4.25% to 4.5%. He noted, this is why he's waiting and seeing. The risks of higher unemployment and higher inflation have risen, he said. And he kind of blamed tariffs for that. He said, we're facing uncertainty around tariffs. The economy shows some signs of resilience as well as weakness. So he's like, I don't want to touch anything while this is going on. And just some history for you, if you don't recall the recent Fed rates. So the Fed hasn't touched the federal funds rates since December 2024. And at that time, it decreased it by 25 bips. I know, like some BIP decreases. So that's what they did back in December. And from then on, it's been a wait and see. I thought you'd enjoy this chart, David. So this is the federal funds rate over the last, like, I don't know, 70 years or something like this. This is a weird chart.
It's a very weird chart. Yeah.
Like, it spikes up in the 1980s, right? This is Volcker.
Distant memory, Volcker era. Neither of us were alive.
Wasn't alive, but bad time to get a mortgage, let me tell you. It's so, like, up to 19%. And then, you know, it's just such a weird chart, these central banker charts, I think. But the interesting thing to me is, like, he was talking about inflation. We haven't seen inflation yet. This is trueflation. Right now, inflation is hanging out at about 1.6%.
Yeah. Inflation is under control.
So far, and of course, this is a trailing indicator. I guess what Powell is just saying is like, well, yeah, it's fine now, but we don't know the impact of the tariffs. And he's expecting that that's going to be inflationary. You can almost read between the lines. He's anticipating some sort of like recession or maybe some sort of, you know, like inflation spike post tariffs. And that's why he's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. Of course, Trump had a comment on that. Did you see his comment this morning?
No, tell me.
Okay. He said Jerome Powell is a fool. Who doesn't have a clue? Other than that, I like him very much.
Mixed signals by Donald Trump. Very mixed signals. Because like Trump wants him to lower rates because it's always good for the sitting president, right? Is that what the deal is?
Of course, right? Sitting president always wants like easier monetary policy, right? It helps him get elected. I guess he says this, Trump continues, oil and energy are way down. Almost all costs, groceries and eggs are down. Virtually no inflation. Tariff money pouring into the U.S. The exact opposite of too late. Enjoy, he says. It's like, I guess he has a point with oil and energy down and cost of groceries down. If you look at the trailing indicator of inflation, this is not a forecast of what the next 12 months will hold. I don't know. What's your take? Do you think Powell should be adjusting rates down at this point in time or hold it steady?
I mean, I do not have an opinion here. What I do enjoy is that rates are being held steady and markets are still finding plenty of reasons to be bullish and go up. I think it's worth highlighting that the S&P 500 is up almost 20% from the bottom of the tariff scare. And the bottom of the tariff scare got pretty low, right? And so that's 31 days. Over 31 days, the S&P 500 is up almost 20%. Over 17 days, we are up 10%, and we are like only from all-time highs, only like 7% away from all-time highs in the S&P 500, despite the tariffs, despite persistently high interest rates. And if we can go up as a stock market while interest rates are like at 4.25%, that means that that's real, like there's no ZERP excuse for why those markets are going up. Markets are going up based off of fundamentals. And that feels good. And that feels like a very strong economy. And that's also true for the crypto space as well. If the crypto space can go up, because crypto up until 2021 only existed in a zero interest rate policy environment. And now in 2024 and 2025, crypto is going up under a sustained high interest rate environment, which means we earned it. We deserved that. That was our success. And that is showing up in our crypto prices.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a bullish interpretation. I will say, like, trailing off of last week, we still haven't seen what impact tariffs might have. Mm-hmm. Perhaps this is kind of a blip up before, you know, we get some tariff shock that happens this summer and recession.
The R word is
we
still
talked
out
about
there.
That. The R word is still out there. Also, there was this capital flight trade that's like outside of the U.S. that seems to have rebounded at least right now. So I guess on the week, it's too soon to tell. But if indeed markets fully recover, right, that was a buy the dip opportunity that a lot of people missed. This is why you got a dollar cost average in and like just like not worry about it. Something else that's hitting all time highs, though, David, is gold on the
still
week.
Still worrying me.
Yeah. Is that a good
I
signal?
Have mixed opinions on this because when I see gold going for all time highs, I think Bitcoin is not far behind that
for sure,
an even more aggressive and explosive fashion. And I think maybe that's what we're seeing recently. But also when gold goes to all-time highs, that just means
uncertainty,
you know, global instability and uncertainty, and also the decline of the United States economy as the epicenter of global finance, right? Like we had a really good thing going. We would export dollars. We would buy goods. They would come to the United States. The rest of the world would get the dollars and they would reinvest in the American financial system. And our loci of control by being the world financial system would increase. And that unraveling, there's no way that unravels without pain. And people pushing gold to all-time highs, I worry, is like a hedge that people are betting on around the unraveling of the financial epicenter of the world being Wall Street, being the United States.
Yeah, gold is kind of a bet on global instability. And I guess it's a kind of an anti-bet on the U.S. dollar. I mean, part of the reason gold is up is because the dollar, the DXY, is down.
Right.
And so that's going on. So I think you're right about this ongoing trade uncertainty is really spiking the price of gold. And that's the story on markets this week. David, what else we got?
Coming up next, a big win, I think, for like the entire world as it relates to the Apple iOS store and especially crypto, because the gates for more free commerce are being blown open inside of the Apple iOS store. So we're going to talk about the significance of that for the crypto industry. What does it mean for crypto to be more intimately related into apps in the iOS store? And also the Ethereum upgrade Petra went live last morning. What new features did we get? Why it's a bigger deal for Ethereum than what I think people think, and also what it's missing and what we still need and what people are now beating the drum about moving forward, because the pace of change in Ethereum is slow and steady, and now we are on to the next upgrade. We're going to talk about all of these things and more, but first, a message to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors who make this show possible, starting with Uniswap. It's a browser wallet, it's a mobile wallet, it's a layer two. It's also the best place to do DeFi. Let's go hear from Uniswap right now. Uniswap is your gateway to a more efficient DeFi experience. With Uniswap, swapping and bridging across 13 chains is simple, fast, and cost-effective, helping you move value wherever, whenever. Thanks to deep liquidity on the Uniswap protocol, you'll enjoy minimal price impact on every trade. And now Uniswap V4 takes it even further. Swappers benefit from gas savings on multi-hop swaps and ETH trading pairs, while liquidity providers can create new pools at 99% lower costs. The best part, you don't have to do anything extra. Each trade is automatically routed through Uniswap X, V2, V3, and V4, so you get the most efficient swap without even thinking about it. Whether you're swapping, sending, on-ramping, off-ramping, or bridging, Uniswap's web app and wallet gives you the tools to unlock DeFi's full potential on Ethereum, Base, Arbitrum, Unichain, and more. Use Uniswap's web app and wallet for a more efficient way to use DeFi. Have you ever imagined Bitcoin and Ethereum truly working as one, unlocking the full potential of Bitcoin DeFi and more? Meet Hemi, a groundbreaking modular network designed precisely for that vision. Co-founded by early Bitcoin core dev Jeff Garzik. Unlike other layer twos that treat Bitcoin and Ethereum as separate silos, Hemi connects these giants into a single powerful super network. With Hemi, users gain unprecedented asset portability and possibilities, combining Bitcoin security and value with Ethereum's versatility. Hemi's unique innovation, the Hemi Virtual Machine, integrates a fully indexed Bitcoin node directly into an EVM, enabling dApps that seamlessly interact with both networks. And with Hemi's proof of proof, or POP consensus, users benefit from truly decentralized, censorship-resistant, Bitcoin-level security. Since its recent mainnet launch, Hemi has rapidly ascended the ranks as one of the top Bitcoin chains. With a thriving global community and robust ecosystem support, Hemi isn't just building a network, it's shaping the future of Web3, DeFi, and beyond. Visit hemi.xyz/banklist to learn more, discover ways to interact, participate in the leaderboard program, and be part of the community that's uniting Bitcoin and Ethereum. Imagine a world where your day-to-day banking runs on a blockchain. That's exactly what Mantle is building, powered by a $4 billion treasury and poised to become the largest sustainable on-chain financial hub. As part of their 2025 expansion, Mantle is introducing three new core innovation pillars that bridge traditional finance with decentralized technology. First is their Enhanced Index Fund, aiming for $1 billion in AUM by Q1. It provides optimized exposure to Bitcoin, ETH, Solana, and USD, complete with built-in yield opportunities. Next, Mantle Banking promises to revolutionize global value transfer through seamless blockchain-powered banking services, bridging crypto into your daily life. Finally, Mantle X blends AI with DeFi to deliver an intelligent, user-friendly experience for everyone. And the best part is that this is all in addition to their already launched products like Mantle Network, METH, and FBTC. Ready to step into the future of finance? Follow Mantle on X at Mantle_official and join the on-chain revolution today.
There's a big win for crypto against the Apple App Store monopoly. A U.S. district court found that Apple willfully violated a court injunction and basically forced them to change all of their guidelines. This came in late last week, David. Why was it a big deal?
I think it's a big deal just because Apple has just had such a strong chokehold on the commerce inside of its own iOS ecosystem. And so they do that in a number of different ways. In-app purchases pay the 30% Apple iOS tax. That still remains. And then previously in 2021, a court ordered Apple to you need to allow users to be able to go outside of the App Store, using regular links and buttons inside of apps in the App Store, allowing users to press those buttons, go off platform and purchase goods from your company, from your product, by getting around the 30% fee. And so Apple allowed that to happen, but with a 27% fee, and after a series of very hostile pop-ups saying, we can't protect you here, there might be scams here, highly discouraging pop-ups. And so they tried to do this with some veil of compliance with the 2021 court injunction. And now they were taken back to court saying no, this 27% fee and all these hostile pop-ups are them doing compliance theater that's still incompliant. And now a court is saying, yo, Apple, cut your bullshit.
Yeah.
And also potential criminal contempt. So this does not end. So as a result of these changes, applications in the Apple iOS store can have clean speak buttons saying, go purchase our goods offsite. They are allowed to say, if you purchase these goods offsite, they are 30% cheaper. And there can be no discouraging pop-ups from Apple to prevent users from doing that. And so, you know, previously, OpenSea's like NFT platform app was all like a browse only.
It's a browse only. It's like
browse
completely
only, which
nerfed.
Is like, what is OpenSea? It is an NFT marketplace.
Right.
But on in the App Store, it is a browse only. You can just view the marketplace. It's nothing.
The whole point
right.
is buying yeah. and selling.
Yeah. And so now there are reduced restrictions on being able to be, I think, pointed even outbound to your wallet, saying like, go buy this NFT. And then like the Coinbase wallet pops up or whatever wallet you want to use.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you can buy that without paying that in-app 30% fee.
Yeah. And the reason OpenSea had to do this is because if they allowed buying and selling, they'd be delisted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the entire, like the whole court case you went through. I was like getting the history of this, right? It all started with back 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this was Epic
the Fortnite
versus
case.
Apple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is Epic versus Apple back in August 2020. And Epic just slipped a direct pay button into Fortnite, you know, so you could directly buy Fortnite skins, items without paying the 30% tax. You know what Apple immediately did back then? They yanked Fortnite. Yeah.
But Fortnite actually baited them to do that because they took them to court the next day. So
yeah,
Apple
so
banning
perfect.
Them was actually bait.
Yeah. And then you went through the history of this whole nationwide injunction. But this was like 5 more years of Apple kind of dragging its heels. And it's like, yeah, we'll comply. And then they added this 27% tax.
Right.
Anyway, now the courts are calling BS on it. And it's resulting in a massive change. So here's Saigar with what this means for cryptos. Apps in the App Store can accept crypto payments rather than routing through the Apple App Store now. So this is huge for integration with mobile wallets where users can spend their crypto directly, USDC, ETH, Solana, all that stuff without having to pay extra fees. Mobile apps for NFT marketplaces will allow buying and selling of NFTs, as you just mentioned with OpenSea, for example. And apps that were previously not allowed to gate any functionality via NFTs can now do that. So do you remember that whole add utility to your NFT where an NFT can be sort of a gate on some sort of functionality or feature set within your app? Apple disallowed that. That wasn't even allowed. Well, now the court is forcing them to allow that kind of functionality as well. So this really opens up the playing field.
Yeah. There's this common idea that, like, you know, everything in crypto is just completely useless except for like scams and frauds and all that kind of stuff. It's because so much of the incumbency of the world prevents us from having utility in our assets.
It's because of Gary Gensler and Tim
It's because
Tim
of
Cook.
Gary
That's
Gensler
why.
And Apple makes our assets useless. It's their fault, not ours.
Yeah, we didn't want these things to be memes, right? Like, we wanted these to be like... By the way, did you listen to the... there was a 4-hour Lex Fridman podcast with Tim Sweeney.
I listened to
Sweeney.
You know, every single hour of all hours of Lex Fridman podcast. No, I need you to tell me about what happened.
All right, so it was good. I mean, it took me back down memory lane to like my early gaming history. Like, I was a big Unreal Tournament player and, you know, such like back in the day. I mean, like, not big. I mean, like, wasn't ranked or anything, but I enjoyed some LAN parties, you know, back in the day. Anyway, there was a whole section... CEO of Epic, of course, the creators of Fortnite. And do you remember that whole theme of like 2022, Fortnite is coming to NFTs? Like Fortnite assets
like
will be listed.
Gaming and NFTs, yeah.
I was kind of a believer back in the day.
I think
and my question going into that episode is like, what are they going to say about it? Uh-huh. And Tim Sweeney had some really interesting comments. So first, he totally agrees that items from Fortnite should be completely transferable to the rest of the gaming ecosystem, Roblox, like all of the other games, right? They should be completely interoperable. Here's a quote from him that I pulled out. If we had a standards body, standardize what are portable outfits in games, game outfits you could buy in one game that work in another, then you could have an item economy where every game agrees to respect each other's item purchases of that sort, and revenue is shared between the ecosystems as well. Huh.
We were right?
Huh.
I thought we were wrong about that.
That sounds a little bit like NFTs, okay? Uh-huh. And so, like, I listened on, but he says basically, no, it doesn't need, you don't need NFTs to do that. What we need are interoperability standards, essentially. And so this kind of caused me to like go down a quest and like dig into this some more.
Interoperability standards sounds like an asset transfer protocol. Like a maybe a global internet-based ledger?
Right. And so where this is all, there's apparently a whole standards body now called the Metaverse Standards Forum, where Epic, Meta, Microsoft, all these game companies have kind of joined, and they're busy like plotting out standards of how you can transfer like a collectible or an item or a skin from one app to another, all of the file formats and 3D renderings. Mm-hmm. But you know what it's all stuck on, David? None of them can really agree on how to like share the revenue.
Right.
Okay.
Interesting.
And so like what, there's a $400 million creator economy for items and skins inside of Fortnite today. But do you know how much creators make on that?
I'm assuming a very low number.
Like 13%, 13 to 20% is kind of their take home. None of these things that they create are like transferable to anywhere else. And none of the game companies can really like agree on how to share the proceeds. And I think it's because what they're missing is like they want portability, but what you need is portable property. And for a property, you need a property rights system that's credibly neutral. It can't be the Epic database. It can't be Microsoft.
Right.
So my prediction, David, is sometime, some point in the future, maybe 5 years in the future, okay, the metaverse, NFT, like games are coming to you, crypto.
The metaverse was just ahead of its time.
It was just
ahead of its
time.
It was ahead of its time.
We weren't wrong. We were just early.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. I agree with that. We're never wrong. We're just early. All right, ready to get into Pectra news?
Yeah, tell me about Ethereum upgrades.
Okay, so Ethereum's 19th hard fork happened last night. Pectra, 19th? Live on mainnet, went off without a hitch, extremely smooth. Pectra was Ethereum's largest hard fork by sheer number of EIPs. So a lot of like tech debt fixing, a lot of some marginal EIPs, but there are three EIPs that I want to highlight that are a very big deal. EIP 7691.
Each EIP is like a feature, right?
Yeah, it's like a line item upgrade a feature. And like some are marginal, some are more like security around edge cases, but then some are kind of like the flagship features. And so there are kind of like three flagship EIPs of Pectra: 7691, 7251, and 7702. So I'll go through these one by one. 7691, EIP 7691, increasing the blob target from 3 to 6. And so what does that mean? Every 12 seconds, there's an Ethereum block. Inside of every Ethereum block, there is space for blobs. Up to 6 blobs can be in any one particular block, but the target is 3. And so if there's more than 3 blobs, then blob space becomes more expensive. If there's less than 3 blobs, it becomes less expensive. And so the target capacity doubled from 3 blobs per block to 6 blobs per block with a max of 9.
And blobs are the fast lane for layer 2s, right? So this is like a subsidy for layer 2s. And I guess from 3 to 6, we're saying there's double the amount of fast lane.
We are doubling the capacity
for layer 2s.
Yes, exactly. So layer 2s can consume even more Ethereum layer 1 blob space. Layer 2s can go faster now, and there also can be more of them. And so there's just a higher equilibrium for the aggregate amount of transactions across the Ethereum layer 2 economy. So that's bullish. Also very simple. We're just doubling the blob space. So Ethereum blob space got doubly big. Then there's the max effective balance. That is EIP 7251. Previously, ETH stakers could only stake explicitly just 32 ETH. Now Ethereum stakers can stake anywhere between 32 and 2048. And so right now, if you have 320 ETH, you run 10 validators, very likely all on the same machine. So 10 independent instances of Ethereum validators on one machine, consuming 10 times more bandwidth than you really need to. And so if you're running 10 validators, you can consolidate that down to one validator on one machine. If you're Coinbase and you're running a bajillion validators, you can also consolidate that down to a much lower number of instances. And so the validator count of Ethereum is going to go down from like a large number to a smaller number. It's not impacting decentralization at all, because it's still the same number of entities at the end of the day. What this does, Ryan, is this seriously reduces the messaging bandwidth overhead that's required for the Ethereum validator network to gossip around information to each other. And so that is becoming, so say there's like 10,000 validators and we go to like 3,000 validators, we're reducing the bandwidth needed by Ethereum by a significant margin. And that's going to happen over time, because, you know, not everyone is going to consolidate all at the same time. This is up to the market. This is up to individuals, but bandwidth goes down. And so that is actually why we are able to increase blob space, is because as we increase blob space, we need more bandwidth. We can't have infinite blobs because that consumes too much bandwidth. But now with 7251, we have more bandwidth to spare. And so we are giving that to the blobs.
And
any questions on that?
Yeah, this is going to happen over time, right? Because to your point, you have to, in order to like run on fewer validators, you have to kind of exit the queue, yeah, there's I believe, a churn. And then you got to go back in.
There's
going to
be a churn process. Yeah,
yeah, so and then you got to set it up and go back in. Okay, okay. So yeah, that's
but,
a second.
But we will have increasing, and like I think the 3-6 target of blobs was conservative because they knew they were going to be able to unlock some bandwidth, but not how much. And so they chose a conservative blob target number. And then we're going to watch how much bandwidth opens up over in the future.
All right. So rollups are super happy, right? Their blob space just got cheaper again, allowing them to onboard more users, more transactions. Yep. How about the third one? The third, I think, is my favorite, actually.
I think the third is the biggest one. So 7702, it's kind of like account abstraction light. So most users, you, me, Ryan, are all using EOAs, externally owned addresses, other than like any sort of Gnosis Safe. Gnosis Safe is a smart contract wallet. What 7702 does is it lets normal EOA addresses run this like one-off contract code, do its thing, execute its contract code, and then reverts back to an EOA by the end of the transaction. So in the moment that it is processing a transaction, it is bestowed account abstraction properties.
Superpowers.
And then by the end of the transaction, it reverts back to an EOA. It happens behind the scenes. And so what does this enable? The big thing that this enables, I think, is batch transactions. And so we can, you know, you can line up a queue of like 2 to, you know, 20, 50, 100 transactions all at once and have them execute atomically.
Yeah.
And what that does is that removes the goddamn approve pop-up. So when you hit the swap button on Uniswap, the thing that happens is it swaps tokens. Rather than having to try and assign a approve transaction, you just swap. The swap button just swaps tokens. That's what it does now. But so it's a small thing, but it's a very big UX. This also reduces the surface area for failed transactions because all of this is atomic. So overall, this is just a transactional user upgrade. There's some other things as well. So applications can now sponsor transactions for their users. And so if you go into like www.myfavoritedefiapp.com, that application can give you a wallet and you can like deposit 100 USDC and then you can charge you USDC for gas. So you don't need to pay ETH for gas. It swaps to ETH in the back end. You don't need to be exposed to that. And tokens can now pay for gas and applications can now pay for their users' gas. And so there's a lot of just abstraction.
It's just such a convenience thing, such a quality of life increase for any kind of like user of Ethereum. You ever been in it like a new wallet and you're like, you're getting ready to do something. You're like, damn, there's no ETH for gas.
Right.
Or like, and like you so have annoying. To go like through a so process annoying. Of going yeah. and sending some ETH and like right. doing all of that. Basically, what it allows is all of the existing addresses that everybody's using to, for all intents and purposes, become, they're not really converting to smart contract wallets, but become a smart contract wallet. Right?
By the end user, the benefits of smart contract wallets are being bestowed upon them.
Yeah, and we've talked about how cool smart contract wallets, you listed out a few other things. I'll just add, you also get native social recovery, possibly. as part, like, that's what smart contracts wallets can do. You also have support for session keys. This is William Pister writing this. So you can grant apps limited time-bound access to your wallet. Social recovery, of course, is kind of cool because that allows, you know, somebody else, maybe a third party, maybe like your spouse or someone like that to recover your keys. So all of these features are being added and essentially upgrading to a smart contract functionality. William Pister also noted that this might be the beginning of the end for wallet sprawl. You know that problem where you get all of these different like wallets and you got to manage
across. Boy, do
I. Yeah, right? Like, I mean, Ethereum users probably by this point in time have like dozens of wallets.
I've probably had 50 wallets over the years.
I mean, and like, yeah, and more. So if an EOA can temporarily act like a smart contract account, then I think users will increasingly just not have to split their identities across all these wallets. That's all great. What about the layer one, though? Did we get any layer one throughput increases this go round?
Okay, so the new, like, memified, simplified roadmap for Ethereum in 2025 and beyond is scale to layer one, scale blobs, improve UX. Petra brought two of the three things. We are drastically improving UX. We are doubling the blob size. There was no explicit EIP upgrade for the layer one in Petra. And I also will say that this is a problem because the next upgrade to Ethereum, Fusaka, targeted by the end of this year, introduces Pure DAS, which is like a 10x increase of blob space.
It's more blob space, more fast
lane. It's more blob space. Yeah. And so with the bandwidth that we are saving from the max effective balance upgrade, we gave it to blobs in Petra, and then we are giving it to blobs again in Fusaka. And so like we're saving these resources, and according to Ethereum priorities, we're giving them to blobs. That is, in my opinion, and many others' opinion, not the best use of those resources. Where does the prioritization of the layer one come into play here? So we need to rethink about, reconsider prioritizing the resources back to the layer one. So Ansgar tweeted, so far in 2025, execution throughput is up 20%, while DA throughput is up 100%. This is a good start. We're ramping up our scaling efforts. Both execution and DA have a path to 1,000% increase over the next 12 to 18 months, then up only for there. But you'll notice we are prioritizing blob space far more than layer one block space. And I think that's good. We need to maximize both of these things. In my opinion, we are under indexing on the importance of the layer one. We have for a long time. We should stop doing that. We should start to reprioritize the layer one. So I would like to see the resources that we are saving and leveraging be applied to layer one scaling. So this is Justin Drake tweeting out, I just configured my node for 60 million gas limit. So this is, gas limit is like the size of layer one blocks. We are currently at 36 million. It was 30 million not too long ago. So that's why Ansgar said we have increased the size of the layer one by 20%. Justin Drake is saying, I configured my validator to a 60 million gas limit. That's a 66% bump from the 30 million limit. And this is safe post Spectra. And then he is calling for validators should set the limit and they can vote with their validators.
Wait, this is something that people don't understand. Cause I think it, like you're saying, hey, now it's time to like, let's continue to scale the layer one, right? But you just said it's not in the next Ethereum hard fork, Fusaka. Mm-hmm. And Fusaka, we're doing 10x more for blob space, right?
That's
not
blob space, yeah.
But what you're saying here is configuring your validator for 60 million gas, that's a way to scale the layer one.
Now.
Outside of hard forks.
Outside, yeah. Okay. So this has always been a power. This has always been a power of Ethereum. So
we could always do this?
We have done this.
Okay.
We could always do this. The Ethereum layer one gas size, the gas limit, is voted on by validators. So validators can dictate, the consensus among the validators dictates the gas size limit. And so it is up to validators to increase the size of layer one blocks. And so Justin is signaling, I have set my gas target to be 60 million, which is a 66% bump. I think all validators, I think we should do this.
Okay,
we
but
should
like, do, definitely how many do you this. Need in order to do this? Do you have to have like some sort of majority or some sort of
there needs to be some sort of like, that's a good question, actually. I'm fuzzy on the details on that. But there does need to be some like consensus, a majority consensus among validators because it's like kind of like emergently decided. But yes, validators do vote. And you're right, Ryan, this is out of, and this is not an EIP. This is just every single individual validator says, hey, I'm targeting 60 million gas and we should totally do this. What I would also like to see, and what I think is more important than layer one block size, is layer one block speeds. And that does need an EIP. And the reason why block speeds is more important than block size is because these are global asset ledgers. We issue assets, we trade assets, we exchange assets. Lower latency on trading on block times means faster trading speeds, smaller amounts of MEV. Tim Roughgarden has proved this empirically. Faster block times reduces the total amount of MEV. It allows market makers to quote tighter spreads. Overall, like DeFi is more efficient with faster block times. And so there's two ways to scale. We can make our block size bigger, which we should. We should also lower the block times. It is a qualitatively better product for what we are trying to do right now. Right now, TradFi is looking at all the blockchains and being like, where should we put our assets? And Wall Street is hypersensitive to getting fleeced by middlemen. And so what has the Ethereum ecosystem been investing in over the last 5 years? It is MEV mitigation. It is fair order execution. We have Flashbots. We have this very sophisticated built out pipeline of MEV mitigation, and we can leverage that fact by reducing block times and having the best execution in all of crypto because of all the infrastructure that we have built out. So I think in addition to scaling out the size of layer one blobs, which Justin is calling for, Ansgar is calling for, I think we should also focus on reducing the block times from 12 seconds down to 8 seconds as just a signal to the market that we understand what we need to do and where we need to go. And so that is also my message for the Ethereum community too.
No, size matters and also speed matters, huh? It's both
speed
those
matters,
things
yes.
in combo.
Yeah, okay. Size and speed.
I get
you know?
It. No, I get it. Believe me, I get it. All right, so it's like, but what is likely to happen? So the thing with Fusaka is that's the next Ethereum hard fork. Mm-hmm. PureDAS is already like there.
It's already there, yeah.
I saw some comments from Tamash. Talking about this, and his take was like, now again, he's executive director, sort of an operational lead over all of this. He's like, okay, in the next 6 months, since PureDAS is already here, we'll do that, and then the hard fork after will be the one where we focus on layer ones, and maybe you get your block time decrease there too.
2026.
You want this to be faster. So do I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, so the Pier Das in Fusaka has already been established like a long time ago. It's been that way for a while. And so like the turning of the ship, the Ethereum pivot is being put at the end of the queue, which means that's for Clampsterdam maybe, which already has like a pretty solid.
What's Clampsterdam for people? That's the
Clampsterdam,
next one.
Clampsterdam is the hard fork after Fusaka.
Yeah.
Fusaka is like all of the Ethereum hard fork names are portmanteaus of a big star and a city out there, DevCon cities. And so Pectra is Prague and Electra. Fusaka, I don't know. Yeah. There's a star in a city out there. You slap them together, you get Fusaka.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Clampsterdam is something in Amsterdam. And so, yeah, it would be very good if Ethereum shipped 8-second block speeds as soon as possible.
I agree.
It would be amazing in 2025.
I also think that if you got Fusaka in 2025, that would be a huge operational victory.
Yeah.
Even if just Pier Das is in it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So, yeah, we got some good things on the horizon for Ethereum, I think. It's really like, doing well.
And not to say that like blob space isn't important. We have just simply emphasized blob space quite a lot. Also, there are people, there's now a product effort at the EF around layer twos. And so we are not just naively expanding blob space. We are also working on layer two interoperability standards. And so increased scale, we can actually turn that into increased layer two cross-chain composability too. So it's not just naive blob space scaling.
Because it's a blockchain. It's not a blob chain. That's not all we do is make blobs. We also got to make our blocks better.
Yeah, that's right.
David,
that's right.
A lot more to talk about. What do we got?
Coinbase makes a massive acquisition, the biggest acquisition in crypto to allow it to go toe-to-toe with some big giants in TradFi. Also, like you said, the White House wants a roadmap to $2 trillion in stablecoins. What are we doing to get there? And the Bitcoin community goes through a heated debate about a potential upcoming upgrade in the Bitcoin ecosystem. And I'm going to tell you, Ryan, I think it mirrors quite a lot of the blob space conversation that we just had
just 10x more hardcore. That's
All right, so we're going to get to all of that and more. But first, a message from some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible, like Frax and the Frax stablecoin. And it's got some of the best yields in DeFi. Frax is kind of like if Circle, Athena, MakerDAO all had a baby. But they also have a Fraxel Layer 2, an OP stack chain juice up for max throughput and application ecosystem support. So let's go ahead and hear from Frax right now. In the wild west of DeFi, stability and innovation are everything, which is why you should check out Frax Finance, the protocol revolutionizing stablecoins, DeFi, and rollups. The core of Frax Finance is Frax USD, which is backed by BlackRock's institutional Biddle Fund. Frax designed Frax USD for best-in-class yields across DeFi, T-bills, and carry trade returns all in one. Just head to frax.com, then stake it to earn some of the best yields in DeFi. Want even more? Bridge your Frax USD over to the Fraxel Layer 2 for the same yield plus Fraxel points, and explore Fraxel's diverse Layer 2 ecosystem with protocols like Curve, Convex, and more, all rewarding early adopters. Frax isn't just a protocol. It's a digital nation, powered by the FXS token and governed by its global community. Acquire FXS through Frax.com or your go-to DEX, stake it, and help shape Frax Nation's future. Ready to join the forefront of DeFi? Visit Frax.com now to start earning with Frax USD and staked Frax USD. And for Bankless listeners, you can use frax.com/r/bankless when bridging to Fraxel for exclusive Fraxel perks and boosted rewards. Imagine verifying yourself without handing over personal data. No hacked databases, no unnecessary personal exposure for airdrops, and no AI bots ruining community governance. Meet Self, the on-chain identity verification protocol built for privacy and control. Self protocol uses zero-knowledge proofs to confirm your identity safely. Users prove key details like age or citizenship without revealing sensitive personal information. Self never stores your data. It only generates cryptographic proofs. Here's how it works in 3 steps. First, register and verify. Use the Self app to scan your biometric passport's RFID chip. Self verifies authenticity with zero knowledge proofs. Each passport creates one unique identity. Second, you can share proofs privately. Third-party apps request identity proofs, like confirming you're over 18. You can also link proofs securely to public wallets for airdrops or governance participation. And then last, secure verification. Apps validate your proofs instantly on-chain, like on Celo, or off-chain. Audited by ZK Security, the Self app is live on iOS and Play Store. Visit self.xyz and follow Self Protocol on X.
Biggest acquisition in crypto history, I think, Coinbase to acquire Deribit, becoming the most comprehensive global crypto derivatives platform. What's the story here? What's Coinbase doing?
Yeah, so Deribit is an options platform not allowed to U.S. citizens. So offshore options platform for Bitcoin and Ether. Definitely the largest amount of options volume in the space. And Coinbase bought it. $2.9 billion in a cash and stock deal. So $700 million in cash and $11 million in coin shares. I guess this will close by the end of the year pending like regulatory sign-off. So we need some regulators to say that this is okay. But yes, I'm pretty sure, the largest acquisition in crypto's history, one of the largest M&A deals ever. And yeah, it's pretty. So what does this allow Coinbase to do? This is Coinbase's like going toe-to-toe with things like the CME or like other like derivatives or options platforms inside of the United States with Bitcoin and Ether and make it available to U.S. citizens.
Well, this is like,
please.
Yeah, this is like kind of, you know, Binance, right?
Yeah.
Like Binance has some of this market, but Deribit handles 90% of Bitcoin ETH options open interest right now. And as you said, all of that's international. So Deribit is like located in Panama. And it doesn't actually allow for U.S. customers. I wonder if Coinbase just saw the opening with kind of the existing softened regulatory regime and was like, hey, we're going for it. This is a big like tuck-in acquisition. Now we're a lead in the crypto options market internationally. I think it's like a good one for Coinbase and certainly like, yeah, it just cements their lead as an exchange. I wonder what Binance is going to do in reaction.
Yeah. Congrats to Deribit. They've just been grinding on that platform for a long time.
I think this also positions Coinbase for the big stablecoin win. So I think the U.S., David, is now, we could say it, on a path to $2 trillion in stablecoins. And it's not just me saying it. This is the Secretary of Treasury, Scott Bessent, saying it. This is him in front of Congress.
We believe that the United States should be the premier destination for digital assets. And as members of this committee and the Senate are attempting to do, create good market structure so that U.S. best practices are used around the world.
And that's really the point, right, is having American U.S. best practices to sort of set the pace for others to follow rather than us trying to fill in the holes that may be created by as others set that pace.
Yes, sir. And also that digital assets are an important source of innovation that will drive that can drive usage of the U.S. dollar around the world, as with stablecoin legislation. There is speculation that there may be up to $2 trillion of demand over the next few years for U.S. government securities from digital assets.
Hear that? $2 trillion in demand, okay? And this is, what a 180. This is the Secretary of Treasury. Yeah. What a 180 from Janet Yellen. Who's basically like kind of on the cusp of banning all things crypto, certainly never talking about stablecoins at this level.
I'm very grateful that this is a Scott Bessent who is saying these words, because Bessent's stock is up with Donald Trump, whereas other like Commerce Secretary Lutnick, his stock is down.
Oh, really?
And he's the Cantor Fitzgerald Tether guy.
Oh, right.
And so
right.
You could have easily imagined a universe in which the Cantor Fitzgerald Tether guy is trying to like do the stablecoin things, but his stock with Trump is down, and Bessent, thankfully, is actually the guy pushing the stablecoins in addition to like doing things in Trump's favor, and so. Good stars are aligning. Happy case.
In the background, I don't know if you saw this, Tether is actually planning to launch a U.S. version of USDT. Did you see this?
Yeah, I did see this. And Rob Haddock from Dragonfly had him on the show to talk about stablecoins, and he predicted that Tether would do this. He said, like, yeah, rumors are going to be that Tether does a U.S.-centric stablecoin to comply with U.S.-centric regulations because they are not going to pivot the current Tether strategy to make that work.
Yeah, why would they? It's working so well. It's printing
great.
So much money.
Yeah, and he was bearish on the United States Tether stablecoin.
Interesting. That's an interesting take. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Paulo says a domestic, this is the CEO of Tether, a domestic stablecoin would be different from the international stablecoin. And he says it's all going to be dependent on the timeline of the final legislation. So are we still doing, like, is Paulo coming on the show pretty time soon?
Yeah. So we scheduled an episode with him with a special co-host who I think is extra informed and extra equipped to ask Paulo questions that I think are beyond. I think you would be great, and I think actually the interview is with you and our special co-host. Oh. But like this special co-host, I think is going to ask the best questions.
We'll have to ask Paulo. Okay, so and then he mentioned legislation here. So what is the status of legislation? You informed me last week because I forgot the names. There's the Genius Act. That's in the Senate.
And don't say that one first. You have to say the other one first.
The Stable Act, which is in the House, and then the Genius Act, which is in the
Senate. Genius Acts.
Right, so I was doing some research on this, and it seems like the Genius Act is the one to keep an eye on because, like, first of all, the Senate is more important than the House, and secondly, has a greater chance of actually happening. You know, the Senate has to co-sign anything else, and so, you know, if Genius can get 60 votes in the Senate, then it's on, baby. The U.S. has its an actual stablecoin legislation. This week, Democrats were saying, 9 Democrats in particular, who had been presumed to be on board with the Genius Act, were saying, they're getting cold feet. We're not sure we want to do it. And they cited a few things.
Seems unexpected. Seemed expected.
Really? You expected this?
Yeah, well, some amount of like pushback from the Democrats. I think it would be unexpected if Democrats are just like, you know, please waltz right in and let's get this bill signed. I think there has to be some amount of pushback.
They were kind of warming to like crypto, it seemed like, right? I mean, I think they realized that crypto is just not the hill to die on. Like post-election, losing the election.
Yeah.
But so this was somewhat unexpected, I guess, from folks working on this bill in Congress. And they said, we want more anti-money laundering. We want more national security. We want more
anti-terrorism, anti-child trafficking stuff.
All the same things.
Blah, 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 blah.
So Democratic Senator said, you know, Bill Hagerty, he's actually one of the co-authors here. He's like, we have a choice to make. We either move forward or we let the Republicans own the whole digital asset issue. So he's trying to shake the Democrats into you guys want to be like, you want to be pro-crypto, all right? We just learned anti-crypto is like not going to win you any votes. It's not going to win you any elections. So like, why are we just ceding this to the Republicans? So there is some further rumor that like, okay, the Democrats are kind of like getting behind this. They're getting some changes for it. And I don't know. I don't know what the chances of this getting approved are, but I think it's greater than 50%. So at least my take. But I somewhat wonder if the Trump coin is slowing it down a little bit, David.
Okay, so this is the RSA conspiracy that I'm not totally sure I'm on board with. So tell me about this like belief that you have.
Okay, so this week too, right, the Democrats introduced legislation that would ban sitting presidents from issuing tokens.
I wonder why they did that. Why did they decide to do this?
All right, so who's on this bill? I'm sure Elizabeth Warren is on there. Oh, yep, there she is. There's Elizabeth Warren. Yeah. See, I told you, crypto, like anti-crypto army, like raising its head. But okay, so currently, people who wish to cultivate influence with the president can enrich him personally by buying cryptocurrency he owns or controls, said one of the senators, Senator Merkley, who's behind this bill. This is a profoundly corrupt scheme. It endangers our national security and erodes public trust in the government. Let's end this corruption immediately. Okay. I would have preferred Trump to be like super pro crypto, Bessent to do, you know, the $2 trillion in stablecoin thing, and Trump just not to have launched a meme coin.
Yeah.
Like that would be my preference because then you wouldn't have stuff like this.
Right. Yeah.
You wouldn't have that pushback.
I don't see anything wrong with this. I think it is good
policy. Bill, you're saying.
This bill. Yeah. I think it is good policy to say that presidents and sitting congressmen and women, senators, ought not to be able to create financial assets, crypto or otherwise, SPACs included, during their term. I think all the creation of financial assets downstream of like a sitting, you know, congressman, man or whatever, president, that should not happen.
It's surface area for corruption, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we sort of talked about this with the Pelosi Act last week. That Democrats were going to come up with some anti-meme coin type thing. Here it is, anti-meme coin thing.
Yeah. And like, I don't think there's anything wrong with this.
This is look at this. Do you see this poster here? The Trump gala dinner. Trump, of course.
Gala dinner. Is it a different dinner than the first dinner?
No, this is
it. Oh, it's just now also a gala.
Actually, no, this is May 22nd. This is if you have the if you're one of the 250 people with the largest holders of the Trump meme coin.
The Trump meme coin dinner. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The dinner is still on, is what I'm saying. And Trump's like, yeah,
now it's a gala. That's an upgrade. That's an upgrade.
Yeah. And this is a Bloomberg analysis report. Most of the top holders of Trump's meme coin who are vying for this intimate dinner with President of the United States are likely foreign. Hmm. You see some of the names on this?
Do you just automatically get a visa to come? Like, just Justin Sun just get free, please come to the United States and come to the gala. You know, Justin Sun is the largest holder of Trump meme coin, right?
Yeah, he's got 16 million. Literally, that what is that? That's buying influence, is this not? Yeah. I mean, he's going to be one of the people who could be at this dinner. And of course he's going to be at this dinner. Why would he not be at this dinner?
Right. Yeah.
He's going to be at this dinner.
He's also the biggest investor in World Liberty Financial.
All right. So do you want to hear, there's actually an interview this week where a reporter brought up the meme coin, the Trump coin.
No way.
Here's what he said.
No way.
This is it.
Ask you about something I don't think you've been asked much about, which is you've branded your own cryptocurrency. The coin's values actually surged recently after you announced that top holders would be invited to have dinner.
I don't even know that. What did it surge to?
What did it surge to?
Yeah, what's it worth? You might as well tell me, because I have no idea.
Well, it surged. I will find it. Hold on one second. 5.2 or 58%. So 58%.
To what number?
That's not bad. 14.32.
What?
14.32 what?
No, dollars per cryptocurrency.
$1 billion?
No.
What's the number? I mean, what is the amount?
The meme coin's value hit a peak of 75.35 on January 19th.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean anything.
And that's before your inauguration, and then it surged.
Look, I'm in favor of crypto.
He's just trying to bait her into talking about the multi-billion dollar market cap.
That when they hear that, they worry you're profiting from the presidency.
I'm not profiting from anything. I started this long before the election. I want crypto. I think crypto is important because if we don't do it, China's going
to. So there is a reporter struggling with the concept of like market cap,
of
right? What is the Trump market cap right now?
That is a good question. But yeah, he totally knows what it is.
He definitely knows.
It is fully diluted $12.5 billion valuation. So he was trying to get
Wait. $12.5 billion?
Yeah, FTV. Yeah, 2.5 billion market cap, 12.5 billion FTV.
That's nuts. And that's because 80% is basically owned by Trump.
Yeah, Trump and company. Yeah.
And that's so, like, incredible.
He was trying to bait her. It's like, say it's worth $12 billion. Say the Trump coin is worth $12 billion.
That's what he's trying
to do.
I
don't know if she was like, I'm not going to do that, or I don't even know what that means.
I think she doesn't know what it means, right?
Trump's
saying, like, I don't even know the price. It's not important to me. I've been doing this the whole time. When did he launch it? He launched it sometime in January, right?
Yeah, early January. Like, it was like right before Inauguration Day or something.
He goes on basically in that interview to talk about fantastic things about crypto, how it's the future, all of the things that like crypto, you know, wants to hear. I guess my point is, it's just shrouded by this whole meme coin thing, and that's just fodder for opponents of crypto to just say, hey, it's always been a scam, you know, like we told you so, it's a vector for corruption, all of these things. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's just not ideal from my perspective, right?
You got that's an understatement, bro.
Okay, but like what I mean is, you got some on the left who basically their solution to crypto would just be like, ban it.
Europe global ban this week.
Do you see this? Europe this week. Europe, EU to ban anonymous crypto accounts and privacy coins by 2027.
Yeah, that's bad.
That's literally what the Biden administration future held for
Europe
us, right?
Europe is just all Democrats.
Okay. So we went like to the other side, and now we got to deal with a little bit of the grift tax.
Right.
And I guess that's better.
Quite a lot of the grift tax.
Not ideal. Not ideal.
It's not ideal. Well, that's why I'm a fan of like, hey, let's throw the Democrats a bone. I don't even think it's any amount of concession to say sitting presidents can't issue crypto assets.
Yeah, but then lose Trump's support. he kind of wants the Trump coin.
It's not that bad.
You're like, still a billionaire,
buddy. We become more bipartisan if we get that bill signed.
Yeah, well, that's my ideal. More stablecoin stuff. This one's for the nerds, though, Dave. This is for the devs, okay?
Well, tune out for this one, then, because I'm not a nerd.
You know, you've heard of 404 errors, right? You know, like go to website, server request
fail. Yeah, like website not found or whatever?
Yeah, website not found. That's been in the original kind of, you know, HTTP internet specifications from the very beginning. Do you know what a 402 is?
No clue.
Okay. 402 was the error that never completed. That was the web standard that was never fully finished. It was a payment web standard, okay? And it's literally sat on the shelf from 1992, the Tim Berners-Lee drafts, okay? So basically, it was a standard where you could call a service on the web through, you know, HTTP web-type protocols, and the service would return some sort of, like, you would pay it, and the service would return some resource or some feature in exchange for your microtransaction payment.
Commerce-gated content on the internet? Pay-gated content on the internet?
Exactly. And you know Mark Andreessen's, like, how he has this line of the original sin of the internet was we didn't add payments to the internet?
Right. Uh-huh.
This is the original sin. It was like, we never finished the 402 specification.
Wow, okay.
So it's
turns out I am a nerd
because
this is fascinating.
All right, for the last, like, 30 years, it's sat dormant, okay? Uh-huh. Until today, until now. So Coinbase is bringing it back, 402, a new open source payments protocol built on HTTP Rails. Okay, so they're filling out the specification. And what's kind of cool here, here's the example. This is actually Claude. So this is AI chatbot and users asking, what's the weather? It's calling an external weather source, paying that external transaction using 402, like cents in stablecoins, and the weather service is returning the answer. Microtransactions for AI bots settled on Base, which settles to Ethereum, using stablecoins. All right?
What?
Kind of cool, right?
Wow. Yeah. I remember this brings me back to like the 2017 microtransaction IoT like narrative of crypto.
Yeah. See? We weren't wrong. Just early.
We're never wrong. We're always as early.
Anyway, I think this is super cool.
It's really cool.
Under the radar, but like you can, like, this is probably the protocol that like bots can use, will use. And Coinbase is a stablecoin behemoth is kind of getting behind this. It's open source, by the way. Anyone can use this protocol, right?
Yeah. So I bet you could just like, there's some sort of standards here of like Ethereum address, token contract address for payments.
Exactly.
And it's dominantly going to be like, you know, USDC on the Ethereum base network, but the base network could be popped out for any network. The token payment contract address could be popped out for any token.
Right.
And there's just a standards there.
Well, super important, as all the AI bots are like, you know, taking all of our data from us without paying any of the content creators for it, right? I mean, like having some paywalls in front of it for microservices so that AI bots can pay their fair share.
Wow, that's
cool. No 3% credit card transaction fee, no minimum, you know?
We get to put the last puzzle piece of the internet in. This is like when the puzzle's almost done, but you're missing one piece and you get to put it in.
See, this is how we get to 2 trillion in stablecoins. Mm-hmm. Scott Bessent is right. And like Stripe's doing this too. There's some big releases this week of it using its bridge protocol. I guess they just launched new money management capabilities, stablecoin-powered financial accounts in 101 countries. So like
stablecoin accounts for Stripe accounts. So all Stripe accounts have a stablecoin account now too.
All right, that's stablecoins. Tell me about the Bitcoin debate.
Okay. So this is going to start to mirror a lot of the same words that we're using in the, like the block versus blob size debates. And so this is a Bitcoin split over this op return debate, the op return outputs. Op return is kind of like call data for Ethereum. It allows
blob
for arbitrary.
Space. It's like blob space.
It's blob space. Yeah. Call data is be less like give me the data that you want to be called by other contracts. I think that's right.
Yeah, sure.
And then we just formalize that into blobs. Like, okay, let's create blobs, this arbitrary space for data. Op return is the same kind of function in Bitcoin where you can just put arbitrary data in. It's not the only place that
Is that where ordinals is getting stuffed right now?
Exactly.
Op return?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It is not the only place that you can put arbitrary data in, and this is a big conversation and a big talking point, is you can kind of, blockchains are just data ledgers, and we format these data to become like, you know, transactions and ledgers, but it's really just a database at the end of the day. So data goes into blockchains, so there's no removing, putting arbitrary data into blockchains.
Yeah,
so
Bitcoin transactions are just data,
data. Op return is kind of this like an almost pseudo enshrined, you can just put your data here.
Yeah.
And right now there is a cap, like this 80 byte cap size limit on op return. And some parts of the Bitcoin community wants to remove that cap limit, which is like if Ethereum increases blob space.
Mm.
So the proponents argue that supporters believe that arbitrary data storage on Bitcoin is inevitable. Trying to suppress it only leads to more harmful workarounds, like securing data in other ways or doing private deals with miners. The proponents argue that op return is the least damaging method. It's a small, provably unspendable place to put data, and it also avoids polluting the UTXO set. So other solutions to put data into Bitcoin requires sending Bitcoin transactions, just making UTXOs with data in them, whereas op return does not.
They're basically like people are going to hack it anyway, so you might as well formalize it.
Exactly, yeah. The critics argue that removing the limits on op return invites more spam and non-monetary data into Bitcoin blockchain graffiti, crowding out financial transactions and burdening nodes. And so there's this notion of like legitimate and illegitimate Bitcoin transactions. And, you know, legitimate Bitcoin transactions are ones that are made for commerce that use Bitcoin as money. And illegitimate Bitcoin transactions are ones that have arbitrary data in them. But then also it's like, well, who's to say a legitimate Bitcoin transaction is a little bit legitimate Bitcoin transaction? You know who's to say that? The Bitcoin core code. And the only way to make a Bitcoin legitimate Bitcoin transaction is if you pay the fee. And so that, according to the software, is the non-subjective way of interpreting what's a legitimate or illegitimate transaction. If you pay the fee, then it's a legitimate Bitcoin transaction. There is truly a lack of consensus here. This is a split, but this is currently the debate in Bitcoin land. I would say, we'll say that reducing the, eliminating the cap on op return and having unconstrained arbitrary data in Bitcoin would be very good for Bitcoin layer twos, which are a real thing.
Very good for Bitcoin layer twos. But it's like, sometimes I get the sense when I see these kind of debates in the Bitcoin community that like, they just rather not have a network at all. Do you know?
That is true.
Want the asset.
The network is a burden.
The network is a burden because the only purpose of the network is the asset Bitcoin itself, right?
Right.
And everything else is kind of like graffiti.
It's a means to an end.
Yes. It's a means to an end, right? Yeah. And if they could eliminate it, there's a large cohort of the Bitcoin community that kind of would.
Right.
But that limits your ability to scale via layer twos.
The industrial use cases and the jewelry use cases of gold are a burden on gold as a financial asset. And now with Bitcoin, we finally have the most pristine version of a hard money asset. And anything that's not using that is just a burden and a distraction and slows the progress of the hyper Bitcoinization down.
Yeah.
Do I sound like a Bitcoiner?
It's, you know, that was a good invitation. Yeah. You know, and it's funny how hardcore these debates are. So we think debates in Ethereum are hard. Like,
no, dude,
oh my
they are
God.
Arguing over an 80 byte cap limit on an opcode.
Tell me about Uniswap, David. TEs.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so UniChain becomes the first layer two, I think the first blockchain ever to use TEEs for block building, trusted execution environments. So this is technology brought by Flashbots and Uniswap Labs to the UniChain. TEEs isolate execution from tampering even by the operator of the TEE. So it enables verifiable priority-based transaction ordering. So this just mitigates extractive MEV by enforcing transparent auditable sequencing. It reduces the failed transaction costs and wasted gas via revert protection. It also allows for 200 millisecond blocks. And so there are sub-blocks. So a real UniChain block is 1 second, but you have four sub-blocks, so four increments of blocks. So for the end user, it feels like a 200-second block, which is the fastest block in crypto. Arbitrum is at 250, Solana is at 400 milliseconds.
This is just killer execution, right? You were just talking about earlier what Wall Street wants. This is
exactly
what Wall Street wants.
UniChain, if we want to compare the execution of all blockchains, UniChain has the best trading execution technology out of any blockchain in crypto.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident in that statement. And so maybe retail doesn't care because retail is happy to pay 10, 20, 30% slippage on illiquid casino shitcoins on pump.fun. And, more power to them. That pump.fun token, it has the opportunity to do the 1000x. That's why they're all there. That's good. Keep on doing that. Wall Street is hypersensitive to bips.
Yeah.
They pay attention to bips. And this is prioritizing and optimizing, maximizing the return of bips to traders on UniChain.
Do you know what's really also important for bips though is liquidity. You have to have deep freaking liquidity. And I can't help but think if all of the rollups, if the liquidity wasn't fragmented and the user experience felt kind of the same across all rollups and there's one unified liquidity pool, Ethereum would be miles ahead.
You know what we need to do that, Ryan?
What?
We need to have fast finality on the layer one.
Okay.
We need to have fast layer one block speeds. We need to have a coherent cross-chain interoperability standard. Shout out base rollups for tapping into layer one liquidity. And then we also need to scale blob space, which is exactly what Ethereum is doing.
All right. Well, let's see.
With a less than satisfactory emphasis on layer one scaling.
By the way, meanwhile, in TradFi, do you see this? Let's end here. Charles Schwab, CEO, eyeing spot Bitcoin trading. So if you're looking for Bitcoin trading on the spot in your old Chuck Schwab account, okay, that's coming.
I am not looking for that.
It's coming in 2026. So
that is not the product that I am looking for.
I just think it's hilarious how they're all showing up now, just 5 years too late to actually beat out some of the, like, you know, crypto incumbents in this field. So, you know, Charles Schwab coming to Bitcoin here.
Hold your breath, Bitcoiners, for trading Bitcoin on Charles Schwab in April of 2026.
So here we are. ETH feels like it's slowly getting back on track. David, stablecoins going to a trillion.
Two trillion
app stores opening up. Yeah, feels pretty bullish on the week, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what else I'm pretty bullish on, Ryan?
What?
You listened to the AI roll-ups with me, Jaws, and Josh.
I did. I
think that those are killer episodes. I have a ton of fun doing them with Josh and Ajaz. We are rolling out, Bankless is rolling out our second podcast. It is called Limitless. This is not a joke. This is for real. We are spinning out all of our frontier tech content, which I'm just pilled about AI. I'm pilled about frontier tech. We have enough content and enough like co-hosting power to build out a second Bankless podcast called Limitless. So this is the call to action. There is a new YouTube channel. There will be a new Spotify out soon called Limitless. Go subscribe to that podcast. We're putting the AI rollups on the Limitless podcast. We are putting all of the frontier tech conversations on the Limitless podcast. We are interviewing founders in manufacturing, founders in like space exploration, robotics. Josh is just a huge robotics bull. So anything that's going to materially shape our world, especially AI, we are building out this podcast to explicitly explore those frontiers so that you will get the Bankless podcast feed focused on crypto and markets, crypto macro markets, TradFi, all things crypto, and then all things AI and frontier tech will be going on Limitless. So if you are listening to all those things, go subscribe to the YouTube, go subscribe to the podcast when it comes out. Make sure to give us a 5-star review. I'm pretty stoked.
You know, I've got two podcasts coming out on Limitless that I'm guest hosting, David.
Ryan is also a host on Limitless too.
Occasionally. For subjects that are super interesting. Yeah, I'm very excited about what we're doing in that space too. Of course, guys, you know, crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.